round jump, proper jumps, like real hedges and ditches and that sort of thing. But we didn't go on the road, you had to go straight across country. If you had to go through a gate, the hedges were too high, all those last man had to shut the gate behind him, you see. You've got to learn to do that while you're mounted, up and shut the gate while you're mounted.
You told me yesterday that you only were allowed to hold the reins with one hand.
That's right, yes. You'd four, like that, you see. And right from the start, these horses were trained to turn, not on the bit, but on the neck. You move your hand either left or right, and if you wanted to turn your horse to left, you move your hand across to left. The right hand reins touched his neck, and he would spin around like a top, which is much more effective and less severe on the horse's mouth than driving on the bit, pulling your rein, you see.
Yeah.
Especially with a horse at it which had a hard mouth.
Why did you ride with only one hand?
Well, the old-time cavalry training was that your right hand must be free for your sword or your lance, and even though we didn't have swords or lances, your right hand had to be free. Although we did use the right hand for reeling up wire, we were taught to lay telephone wires on a horseback. We had a harness, which was a heavy belt, supported on one side by a strap round your left shoulder, and on that side there was a big pad with a spindle sticking out of it, and you had a drum which had a knob on it with 300 yards of D2 wire. That's the thinnest wire we use, you see. And we were taught to lay that wire. You had two spare drums in panniers on the side of the horse, on the saddle, you see. That wire, you had two spare drums in panniers on the side of the horse, on the saddle, you see. You spliced, made a joint with the insulated tape, that, you know, and then ran out the next wheel, and then ran out the third wheel, you see, and then you had to reel them back again. That was your training for telephone work, and we never used the horses for laying lines in front. We didn't have the horses up at the battery at all. Only about once, that's all, when you're very quiet.
When you were having this training, were you always laying the wires on the ground?
Yes.
Didn't you sometimes?
Sometimes you laid them on, put them up on a hedge or anything like that, you know. Mm. Or if you had to, say, rake along a hedge, and on the ground, right, you came to a gateway. Well, you couldn't leave it on the ground for fear cattle trampled it, that was the idea. So you put it up the hedge. Or sometimes you'd make a pole crossing. You know, two poles.
I see.
We were taught to use telegraph poles for it because we were equipped with climbing irons, you see, so you could string a wire along those. But of course, the time you got to France, all the telegraph poles had been knocked down.
What are climbing irons?
It's an iron, which, it's like a iron bar which goes underneath your foot from inside, and it has a strap at the bottom and a knee pad at the top on the inside of your knee, and a strap there, and then on the inside at the bottom there's a little spike sticking out at an angle below the horizontal, and as you went up a pole you banged your foot inwards each time so that the spike took a grip on the post, and you went up like that, and you had a belt around you, from a climbing sort of belt, you see, attached to your own belt, and that was around the post, you see, and you kept lifting that belt up, you see, and then banging the iron a bit more, lift the belt a bit more and bang it in the two irons in a bit more like that.
Don't get too carried. Now, when you were doing these signalling exercises, one of the pieces of equipment you mentioned... Oh, it's just finished a reel here. Now, amongst the equipment you used, some of it, you told me, was pretty archaic. Some of it was Boer War equipment, like the 4.7 guns.
Yes.
What about the signallers of equipment? Was that of any great vintage as well?
Well, I don't know what sort of signalling equipment they had in the Boer War. The telephone that we had was reasonably efficient. It worked on two 1.5-volt batteries, three dry batteries. That was 3 volts, you see. And mostly we used it for Morse. But not close up the line. When we were in France, we used a fuller phone. Then that
a
didn't
what?
A fuller phone, they called it.
FULLER.
Yes, that didn't give out a buzz like the other one did. It sent a steady current along the line, which became a buzz at the other end. But you see, with Jerry's listening equipment up in the front line, it could pick up the vibrating signal, but it couldn't pick up the steady signal.
Was there an actual difference in the notes between the various kinds of equipment?
You can adjust the notes yourself according to your with a screw, you see. The higher the frequency of the armature blade, the higher the note, of course, it went. And you could adjust the travel of the key as well. I like to short travel and a high note as well.
What sort of range finding equipment did you use when you were training?
They only had that one at Sunk Island, the Barron Strout, but we only went there for tests, that's all, but we never used it. Of course, it was a permanent coastal defence thing. But we didn't have any range-finding equipment in training at all.
How did the Barron Strout work, the Barron Strout range-finder?
Well, it's the same idea as your own eyes. Your line of sight from each eye meets on the objects, and that alters the angle. And from that, you can determine the range. Well, on the Barron Strout, the left-hand one was a fixed angle of 90 degrees. The right-hand one, you could alter it by means of what they called a Prandtl prism in the right-hand tube. You altered that, and at the same time as you were moving that, you were altering the range on the drum. And when you had made coincidence, that was your objective on the left eyepiece, you saw both objects, one superimposed above the other. And the idea was to get them dead in line, say a ship's mast. You have the one ship mounted on top of the other, the mast to mast. You would then light up with a little button the other eyepiece, which would show you the range jumps, like a speedometer. Worked exactly the same principle, you know, the Marlings recording party, the drums were revolved like that. And that would read out the range.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That had a range of 40,000 yards, that one on the coastal defence.
Mm. Before you went to France, you changed over from 4.7 inch to 60 pounders.
Yes. Mm. We got those in the early part of 1916. Mm. You say, and as soon as we got those, things started moving fast.
Yeah. When you got the 60 pounders, were there any sort of operational differences in handling them as compared with the 4.7s?
No, not really. They were more up to date gun in this much that it was designed as an actual field gun, not as a naval gun, and it had a very long traverse, a very long recoil, you see, which made the gun very steady. You didn't have to keep relaying it every time you fired a shot like that with a 4.7. Honestly, bloody hopeless on the ground, you know.
But for the members of the gun crew, were there any differences at all in handling the 60 pounders?
Not at the actual service, except that they didn't have to keep pulling it back into position. We could get, for a time, with a 60-pounder, if we got the order gunfire, that means as fast as you can get them off, we could do 3 rounds a minute. And that consists of, first of all, you put the shell into the breech, and then you have a long ramming tool, a drift, they call it. You stand with your back to the gun after you put that in, and ram it home, because the driving band must bite on the lands. Otherwise, if it was short and then banged up against them by the cartridge, it would tear the driving band loose and the shell wouldn't go its proper range. When you put that in, you put the cartridge in, which was tied at one end and had a red patch on the other end. Well, that red patch was the ignition end with black powder underneath that red piece. You pushed that in, then you closed the breech, which closed the breech block itself, had threads on it. There was three sections of 60 degrees and three blanks. And the breech ring to which the block entered had the same. And when you entered it, the threads went into the blanks. Well, then the lever had a link connecting it from the lever itself to the bottom of the breech block. And when you closed the breech lever further, that link caused the breech block to revolve by 60 degrees, thereby locking all the threads together. And at the front end of the leading end of this breech block, there was what they called an obturator pad. That was a sort of a pad with a sealing ring around it. And when it was compressed, finally, that sealing ring prevented any blowback of gases, you see. Mm-hmm. Well, then there was a hole right through the breech block, by which means you ignited the cartridge. You put in a little tube, revolved it 90 degrees, which locked it. And then there was a little loop on that, metal ring on that. You hooked, you landed into that. And when you pulled that, this caused a flash, almost like striking a match. And the flash went through and impinged on the red end of the cartridge, thereby ignited the cartridge, and that blew the shell out. Mm-hmm. At a muzzle velocity of actually 2,088 feet per second on a new gun, with a 60-pounder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you lost 1 foot per second for every 25 rounds fired. Normally, you used to reckon about 4 feet per second for every 100 rounds.
Why did you lose it?
Well, same reasons you lose compression on the engines, it wears.
Mm-hmm.
The shell and the gun are like a piston cylinder, aren't they?
Mm.
And as the gun begins to wear, you see, naturally you get a slight leakage of gas. The life of a 60-pounder was supposed to be 3,000 rounds, but at Ypres in 1917 we were firing up to 5,000 rounds because we never had the six guns in action. The rate of firing was such that a gun wanted a new tube in about every 3 weeks.
Really?
Yes. Mm. We never had the... We used to go down to take them down to Saint-Omer, behind, you know, to... there was an ordnance depot there. Mm. We'd take them down there, and we'd bring in... our own gun would be slung under the shear legs. The piece, the barrel, would be taken out, you see, and a new piece, a relined piece, they'd put into our gun, and they'd come with it like that. You didn't wait while your owner's done. Mm-hmm. Because this tube was detachable. The rifle tube was detachable in the British gun and could be taken out. And a new one pressed in. The German guns are all solid. They had to scrap the whole thing.
I see. Now, you told me that when you went to France, by the time you actually got out there, mm-hmm. you had to relearn practically everything that you'd been taught.
Yeah.
Could you give me some examples of the kind of things you had to relearn?
Well, sighting of lines, for a start. Mm-hmm. The first consideration was you'd got to sight the line so that it wouldn't be damaged by enemy shellfire, which meant, as far as possible, keeping it on the ground or out of the way of splinters and such as that. And also blast, because if a shell dropped nearby, you could have it cut with splinters. Or if you're in the, say, tall grass, and the line didn't get onto the ground, the blast would stretch the line to such an extent that you would break the wire inside, right, sometimes without breaking the insulation. And an experienced signaler, you could tell at once. You used to run your hand along the wire, you'd feel the break inside. Whereas an inexperienced man would go, "Oh, there's nothing wrong with that, it's all in one piece," but it wasn't. There's a break.
Yeah. How would you sight the lines so as they'd be at their least vulnerable?
Try and get it in a dyke side or anything like that. If you found one of these disused railway lines, little railway lines that was not in use, there's a drainage gutter at either side. They used to dig the earth out and pile it in the centre to lay the line, you see, and then a drainage gutter at either side. Well, we'd leave the wire in the gutter, you see. All right. Mm.
Any other tricks you used to use?
No, not particularly.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, give me some other examples of the things you had to relearn.
When we had to go up the front line with them, we had to go to the OP, of course.
The OP?
Observation post. Mm. You had to peg your wire then into the side of the trench. And we used to make the staplers out of the baling wire from the hay bales, you see. To save that and then bend it with pliers and so that we could put your wire and plug it in the trench. Infantry used to come in overnight and with a pack and equipment and catch it in a loop of your wire and tear it out and cuss and swear about it, bloody signaller's wire. Then you've got to go and put it back again. And the wire which they were pulling about was very often, well, to some extent, instrumental in saving them a lot of trouble. Mm. Because if they wanted artillery support and the wire was broken, well, of course, it was a bit awkward. They couldn't get it.
Mm. Any other examples of the kind of things you had to relearn when you got out to France?
We couldn't use the lamps in the ordinary way until we got the Lucas E lamp.
Why couldn't you use the lamps in the ordinary way?
Well, because the beam of a lamp was visible from not only from in front, it was visible from the side as well. And I've known the cases when we've been so far forward, you see, observation, that you couldn't have a wire or anything like that, it might be damaged. Well, we'd use these E-lamps, that was like almost like a fog lamp, about that size, you see, about 5 inches diameter. It had a 12-volt battery and a little switch, you see, like that. The lamp itself had a little spike on it. You could stick the lamp anywhere and you could get down out of cover. I think from 6 or 10 feet of cable to it, you see. But you didn't have to work the lamp yourself. You could get in a hole and stick it so that if anybody shot at the lamp, they didn't hit you. Formerly, the lamps we had, you'd got to work the lamp direct, so that if anybody shot at the lamp, you stood a chance of getting it as well. Mm. So they had filters. You could get a green, a red, or a yellow filter for the light. That was sort of a flexible sort of celluloid stuff, discs. You also had a metal filter, which consisted of two discs. One would revolve on the other, and each of those discs had six holes in it, about, I should say, 3/4 inch across, maybe 1/2 inch. If you exposed the holes fully, you got a reduced amount of light from the reflector, but you could move your disc so that you only got sort of an ellipse, you see, six ellipses, sufficient to be read, maybe 50 or 100 yards away, but not visible to for any great distance, you see. And the thing is, main thing was, there was no actual beam of light. I mean, you can see your headlamp beams, can't you, overnight, from the side. Well, you could see these lamps as well, you see. So, but if you've got the lamp filtered like that, they don't see the beam.
I see. This must have been a problem at most times at night to make sure the enemy didn't see any lights. For example, when you were reading instruments, you would need some light to do that.
We only needed that when we were sort of plotting to find an enemy battery, see. Mm. Normally, ordinary night worker observation party, there was not much doing.
You told me yesterday, though, that there were some occasions when you used to use the light of a cigarette.
Yes.
What was that for?
That was when we wanted to find an enemy battery. We'd have three observation posts out so they could get at him from three directions. All you had to start with was, say, a flash reflected on low cloud or, say, from behind a wood or something like that. But you wanted to know exactly where he was so that if there's a stunt coming off, you'd be able to use sufficient shell fire to put that battery out of action. So you had a director, which was an instrument mounted on a tripod, consisted of a scale fixed to the tripod, 0 to 180, and the 180 was at the front. So you'd want 180 back to zero on either side. You had a ruler sort of thing, which erected at each end with a slot and a wire. Jerry had the telescopic thing with the cross wiring, but we didn't get as good as that. That had a pointer you could move in any direction. Now, before it got dark, you would clamp your director on some known reference points, and after that you mustn't touch it. You would then loosen your sighting rod for use. When the enemy battery started firing, you would gradually get your sighting rod dead onto him, and then on the pointer at the rear you would read off the angle from your reference point, and you did that by cupping your hands over a cigarette, because obviously if you could be in a position to have a direct line of sight towards the enemy, he could also see you if you had a light. The next thing was,
so you just take a pull on the cigarette,
that's right, to make it glow, and you could read it like that. Then you had to determine the distance away he was from you. And to do that, you timed from the flash to hearing the report. Well, from three different observation points, those angles and those times were sent back to brigade. Well, they knew the speed of the wind over the ground at all that area. They plotted back the angles and the distances as worked out by the sound, and that would result in usually a little triangle, which was called the triangle of error, but you could be almost certain that the enemy battery was within inside that triangle.
I see. Good. That's fine. going back to my earlier question about things which surprised you, that you had to relearn, and or jobs you had to do in different ways than you had been trained to do because of the conditions on the Western Front. Were there any other examples you can think of?
Only that we didn't have the horses up the battery, only on about once, I think, that's all, when it was very, very quiet. We had a few horses just to the, you know, out of sight in the wood behind. But they were only used, really, to give them a bit of exercise. Mm. So there was no real need for them.
Yeah. Mm. Now, you told me that under operational conditions, the lines would be constantly damaged by shell fire, and therefore you'd have to spend a lot of time repairing them.
Yeah.
How did you actually go about that?
Well, you...
Tell me about a sort of wire repairing operation.
Yeah. In the first place, you'd know where the shelling had taken place, to some extent, so that you'd have a good idea where it was. Well, you went out equipped with a telephone, to which you had a wire on the terminals, a twin wire, and on the other side end of that wire, you had two safety pins. And you use those to push the pin through the insulation of the wire to make metal contacts. You could then communicate with anybody on that line. So, as long as you could get your battery, say, on that line with the pins, you knew that the line was intact up to there. You'd go beyond that until you reached a point where you only got the other end and not the first end, so you knew then that the break was in between those two.
I see.
So having localised the break, you then proceeded to mend it. You paired the insulation back for about 3 inches either side. You took a double reef on it, not just one turn, a second turn, otherwise the wire would skid and spin. You knotted it like that, then pinch it off with your pliers. Then you had a reel of insulating tape, and you bound it round with that, and probably your uncle, that was supposed to be all out of the repair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a rule. But if the wire, you come to a broken end, of course, well, of course, then you'd got to strike an arc round to find the other line, and then come back, and you'd probably find that the line had been, with the blast, had been blown so far that the other end might be, 20 or 30 yards away, and you'd got to find it in the dark. Stubbing it with your toe very often through the grass, if there were no other lines near.
When you're on these wiring operations, wire mending operations, what were the sort of hazards and problems that you faced?
Well, if he was still shelling, if he'd break them caused by shell fire, because they weren't always that, sometimes they were caused by transport going up the line, you see, by catching them and pulling them down, or... because sometimes you had to have a pole crossing over a hard road. You couldn't dig underneath it. You had to have a pole crossing. Of course, that was always a risk. But if it was still shelling, well, my usual procedure was to draw in the line to a safe distance, then splice a piece onto it.
What do you mean, draw in the line? What would you be doing exactly?
Well,
a bit more detail.
I'd followed the line so far, you see, until I got where he was shelling. Well, it's no good going in there. I'm going to get hit, and the line's going to get broke again, so I might as well pull it clear. And then splice a piece under it, take it, say, 50 yards further round, and find the other end of the wire, and then join up like that, so to leave it clear. Which was far better than... I lost men, inexperienced men, through that, because they'd go in and mend the line, and I went up one night from... when we were at... I was sent for, I wasn't on duty, and the old man rang through for me to go up, and two men had gone out on the line, at one at a time, because we couldn't send two men, we had less than 20 men, and he should have had 31, we're sending one at a time, and neither of them had been heard of, would I go up and see what was happening, because this was the line to the OP, and there was something coming off in the morning at about 6 o'clock, so I went up, not a very nice thought. You go, two of your men have not been heard of for an hour or more. You wonder what's happened to them. Well, one was dead and the other one was unconscious, wounded. First thing is to get the line through, you see. The dead man, I could do anything with him. The other fellow was unconscious, so there you are. I got the line through, you see, and then told him to send a stretcher bearer up, you see, and take this wounded man down. And that's it. I don't know whether he recovered or not. I've no idea. He went down to the dressing station. That's the last I heard of him.
Yeah.
Well, you see, if they'd done as I'd done, I mended that line by taking it further on. I didn't get hit, and the shelling was still going on.
Leaving operational activities for the moment, I'd be interested to have some idea of what life was like in an artillery battery. You know, the most sort of general aspects of life. What you did when you weren't working. How the life in an artillery battery was different, say, from the infantry soldier's life, because you'd be farther back, and there obviously would be differences.
Well, the main amusement, I think, was playing cards, usually a nap or a pontoon, that sort of thing. I'd have the Methodist upbringing, and I wouldn't gamble, and sometimes, to make up the number, they persuaded me to play, and it was a sort of no annexations, no indemnities, they called it. If I won, I didn't... draw any winnings, and if I lost, I didn't pay out. But there was one where I trumped a chap's ace, the last one. He was rather right. He got an up-handy thought, and I spoilt it like that. We used to have a bit of music at times. I have a whistle in there, you know. I took it out with me when I came on leave. I used to entertain them like that, and sometimes you have a mouth over or anything like that, you know. But
did you have any of your own songs? You know, songs about the battery or songs about the artillery?
No, no. There was the usual popular songs, you know. Marry Myself from the Mountains, I Want to Go Home, and all sorts of that, you know. But those are only on marching, when you were marching, but normally you just went about your job. And By the time you'd finish your job, all you wanted to do was get your head down and have a rest. Because when you're working, say, 16 hours on and 8 hours off, and then having to do line landing in your off-duty time and anything like that, when you haven't much time for any recreation.
Tell me a bit about the living conditions with the battery. Were you under canvas or in trenches?
No, generally dug in somewhere, you see, in a bunker or anything like that. Occasionally in summertime you're out in the open. Before the Somme battle we had one place we were out in the open. I remember the most unusual thing there, we laid just behind, there was a bank, it's about 2 feet high, just was a bit of shelter from the morning breeze, you know, and there was very, very heavy dew in the morning, very heavy dew. This was evening, just, you know, about the sun was going down. And suddenly there was a swarm of huge beetles, they were, things about an inch long. And this lot, about, I should say, 2 feet thick, was coming from the east, from the enemy side, just above ground level. For us, I'd say, oh, half an hour or more, what they were, or where they come from, where they're going to, I just don't know, but you could hit that stream like that with a flagpole and knock half a dozen down. They never deviated. We moved it for this, because these damn things, they weren't moving, we moved a few yards out of sand, there was this stream of huge beetles going across like that.
Now, I have a sort of mental picture of artillery batteries, because they were a good deal farther behind the front line, mm-hmm. of conditions being, the physical conditions of living being somewhat more pleasant than those under which, say, the infantry had to live.
Probably better.
I wondered to what extent you managed to make your battery site sort of comfortable for living, whether there were any particular ways you adapted the area for your own comforts.
Well, we moved about quite a bit, so you never had any permanent home, you see. If you were sometimes in near a village, or even if it was a ruined village, you made some sort of use of the remnants of the village, you see, by, say, building lean-tos against the remains of a wall, anything like that. Any timber, anything you could scrounge, such as that, you see, and then put a ground sheet over it, things like that. But before the Somme battle, we were dug into this chalk. It took a long while digging that lot, and we moved off after the first day. We moved up to Carnoy from there. We never dug in like that anymore. We're out in the you know, I showed you that picture. That's where that's in Carnoy Valley.
Yeah. Did you have your own kitchens with the battery?
Oh yes.
How did you do for food?
Stew. That's all we ever had. Stew in Dixies.
Do you mean all you ate every day, 7 days a week, was stew?
Excepting you had rations. These McConachies, they were called. That was a 16-ounce tin which had supposed to have 10 ounces of meat. And 4 ounces of potato and 2 ounces of other vegetable like that. And it was a flat tin. You could heat that up, puncture hole in it, you see, otherwise it would burst, and heat it up on a fire, anything like that, you see. But those were few and far between. Mostly, the cooks got up this frozen meat, you see, and that sort of stuff, and cut it up and made a stew in these dixies. And you went with your dixie and got so much stew ladled out. Morning breakfast was 2 slices of bread with a bacon in between, and if you're lucky, the cook would dip it in the grease for you, and one clapped on top of another like that with so much bacon. That was your breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And for tea, you would say corned beef or sardines or anything like that, but mostly bread and jam. You see, supper there wasn't any, unless you'd manage to save any of your own rations. You see, and because we used to get stuff sent out from home as well, you know.
On the whole, did you do fairly well for food?
Excepting when there's any battle on. The rations came up pretty regularly. Oh yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But the signalers were sometimes at a disadvantage under say real action conditions, because you were out on your own and you couldn't get back to the battle for any rations.
Mm.
I mean,
now you were serving on the Somme front when you first went over to France. What were the main kinds of operations that you were involved in as a battery?
Usually counter battery work and shelling roads to disrupt transport.
Okay, tell me about counter-battery work.
Well, the idea was to knock out an enemy battery to stop him shelling your infantry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what kind of equipment did you use for this purpose, and how did you actually do it?
Well, as I said before, we used to find them by three positions like that, you see.
Yeah, I see.
And also by aerial observation with balloons, and sometimes with planes going over in the early morning, you see, because they couldn't go over much in the daytime in the Somme, because that time Jerry had the master of the air, you see.
Yeah. Tell me about the air shoots. Were they successful, or did they have any problems?
They were not very successful at first, because the only means of communication with the plane was with there was no wireless. We had to fire a very light pistol, and we had a code of signals, red, green, and white.
What did that mean?
Well, according to the order in which you got them, you could have, say, three reds, three greens, three whites, you see, or red, green, red, or green, green, white, green, that sort of thing, you see. We had a code which all they meant. And it was sort of over or short, right or left, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept doing that until you got someone near the target. And our own means of communication with him was with long white strips about 12 foot by 1 foot, which was allowed on the grass.
Yeah.
The Major didn't like it. He used to send us about a quarter of a mile away at least. Then we'd have a telephone line to the battery.
Let's concentrate a bit on the preparations for the Somme battle in 1916. Mm. First of all, can you give me some idea of the scale of the artillery preparation for that battle?
Ooh,
as far as your battery was concerned, tell me what you remember about that.
Out of our four guns, we accumulated 5,000 rounds of ammunition in holes and pits and anything. We dug some pits, but we'd strewn about within the radius of 100 yards behind the battery, you see, so as not to risk too much being hit at once in case the enemy did start shelling around there. And by the end of the first week, that we started bombarding a week before, you see, and by the end of that week, we'd used up all that ammunition, plus what had been brought up as well.
Mm. Could you tell me a bit more about the details of the preparation? For example, you know, how would you bring up the ammo?
We brought up in wagons to the nearest point on the road,